Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. First thing that I wanted to do was announce that this program is the Halloween show. So we're going to start out with all sorts of interesting Halloween-y kind of things, because why not? So the theme for this show is sci-fi and super spreaders. I'll try not to get you too nervous, but you'll have to allow me the latitude of a few COVID-related things. So it's going to be a little intimate radio program for us all today. Let's start with a recent thing that happened just a few days ago that kind of freaked everyone out and led to a change in the CDC's recommendations. And this is, of course, the prison guard who had 22 short encounters over 17 minutes, about 17 minutes of total exposure. And he became infected with COVID. He wasn't in the same room with any single COVID-infected patient, most of them wearing masks for most of the time. The guard was wearing a mask and a gown and eye protection. But let's just say the presumption here is that the exposure was the prisoner's. I'm not so sure that we can make that presumption, but the CDC now defined close contact as someone who's within 6 feet of an infected person for a total of 15 minutes or more over a 24-hour period. So a little change in the recommendations. Oh, hello. A little black-eyed Junko is just sitting on my windowsill. I guess he's a fan and wanted to hear the program. So let's talk about another super spreader event that I just found wistfully ironic. And this happened in Boston in February. New research just came out suggesting that as many as 20,000 infections in Boston in the spring could be traced back to a single conference, a biotech conference at that, that was attended by 175 Biogen company executives from around the world. This was a big conference. Researchers subsequently, there were many, many illnesses, and they got the genetic fingerprint of those viruses. They all shared, all 28 of the people who were from that company who got sick, shared a particular strain. And subsequently, this strain cropped up in hundreds of cases. In fact, it's been found that about one-third of all of the cases sequenced in Massachusetts, and the same strain has showed up in 3% of all of the coronavirus genomes so far studied. So that's what you call a super spreader event. And that's one of the things we all have to be a little bit nervous about. But we know some things, right? We know that masks help, and there's various speculation about how much they help. And they're not perfect, but they definitely help. Even some data came out recently suggesting that besides helping you and not infect others, the straining effect of a mask may actually benefit you by exposing you to a lower risk of the virus because you're just getting a smaller dose. As a physician, I always was very strict about hand washing because I had a sick elderly parent at home, bad lungs, and so I couldn't. I really didn't want to bring anything home. And what I noticed was that I would pick up little bits of bugs, and I would never quite get sick, but I'm sure that I got exposed. And that little bit of bug would often just vanish with a good hot bath. And I think I raised my body temperature and gave my immune system just a little bit of an edge. Small subinoculum doses can act as a sort of passive vaccination. And if the masks turn out to do that for us, then maybe the people who don't want to wear a mask could be persuaded to do that. But we need to stop playing neener neener. This has become a political issue. Everybody on the planet is laughing at us about that. I have a recommendation, and my plan is as follows. I have family in Nevada. I'm going to spend about $20, and I'm going to buy boxes of American flag masks. These American flag masks, and this is from the Planet Earth Disposable Adult Face Mask American Flag, okay? Hard to say no to an American flag. I've written up a little blurb. I'm going to make a lot of copies of that, give them to my family, let them package those blurbs in, along with the masks in a baggie. And what the baggie says is, do you respect veterans? Big question mark. Well, I'm giving you a gift to help you walk your talk. This mask is for you to keep in your pocket. And if you run into an older veteran, please wear it. They protected us. We need to return the favor. Turns out that will cost about 40 cents a mask and a little bit of time. It's psychology, child psychology, right? If a child acts out, you want to say, you know, I know you're basically a good kid. I know that you just lost your temper. I know you don't mean to have hurt somebody. And even if they did mean to hurt someone at that moment in time, saying that you know that they're a good person and you know they didn't mean that actually is a much better strategy than pointing a finger at them and playing neener neener. For all of our sakes, we need to change the spin. We need to reframe this discussion. We need to make this about being a patriot, that wearing a mask is patriotic. And I love these little American flag masks. Going to buy a bunch of them and get my family in various other parts of the country that are not quite as mask diligent as the one I'm living in, to see if we can maybe get some good statistics going in those other places. Now, just in terms of our California statistics, we're not doing so bad, actually. Cases are going up pretty much all over the country, but we are in good shape. So that's something not to be scared about, not to become complacent about, mind you, but good news for the state of California. So, I mentioned we're going to do some science fiction. So, how about cartilage regrowth? Stanford University scientists have successfully grown new cartilage in the joints of arthritic mice. Now, this has been around for a while. Research has been putting stem cells into joints, but they couldn't get good cartilage. All they got were bumps, and the way they were doing it is using a little tiny drill, going in there and drilling holes into the ends of the bone, and that woke up dormant cartilage stem cells, which would come out of the bone marrow and try to seal up the holes. But the problem was they weren't building cartilage; they were building lumps, and it really didn't do much good. However, the researchers found that if they gave a drug which is used for chemotherapy, a drug called Avastin, which inhibits a protein called vascular epithelial growth factor, then they were able to get smooth bone growing. The bone did not summon different type of cartilage. The blood cells and the blood vessels were interfering with the growth of normal cartilage, which is avascular. As stem cells grow into other things, they listen to the chemical signals around them, and they respond to those chemical signals in either the way we want or in the wrong way, because effectively, it's like we're giving them the wrong computer code to do the job, and not too surprisingly, we're not getting the job we're after. Blocking the blood vessel formation made a big difference, and using this vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF, was the key to getting the cartilage to lay out in smooth sheets and turn into articular or joint cartilage. The other drug that they used is something called bone morphogenic protein. That's type 2, BMP2. And this helps initiate bone formation, but it also helped the process to form that smooth cartilage. So we're learning to code stem cells. We're learning to write the programming. And just like computer programming, it's got to be the right thing in the right place at the right time for it to work. So another advance is extra help for neuron grafts, another pre-programming. Trying to help the brain replace neurons that die in Parkinson's disease or other neurodegenerative disorders has been a real holy grail. A research group run by this was Dr. Gantner, and it was published in Cell Stem Cell is the name of the journal. Haven't heard of that one. I'm reading a review. The work looked at a particular protein called GNDF, glial cell-derived neurotrophic factor. And there was some preliminary evidence that GNDF could enhance the survival of grafts of fetal dopaminergic cells. So these were embryo cells, human embryonic stem cells, and these were cells that were programmed to produce dopamine neurons. This is what's missing in Parkinson's disease. So they converted the stem cells using code that we already know, chemical codes, to get them to start to develop. And then they injected them into the striatum of actual rodent brains. What they found was that giving the GDNF late in this treatment actually caused an improvement in function. Even though it slowed the growth of the neurons, it increased synaptic connections, which allowed these grafted neurons to actually integrate and improve more motor coordination. So anytime you're talking about stem cells in the brain, you first got to create them, you've then got to deliver them, and then you've got to send the program information. And it turns out it's time critical. You can't just throw those guys in there and expect them to work. And the reason I'm belaboring this just a little bit on stem cells is every time I fly in an airplane, I come across these ads that show like a really gnarly arthritic knee, and then next to it there's this really normal knee, and it's some doctor in Florida who's going to inject stem cells into your knees and the angels will sing and you'll grow back your cartilage. And it's just not that simple. Just not that simple. Our first email comes from Columbus, Ohio. Judy writes, dental implants, scintillating scotoma, and Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. That's Wolff-Parkinson-White. Hello, Dr. Dawn. Thanks so much for your show. I've been listening for years and appreciate your thoughtful and clear medical analysis and explanation. I have three unrelated health questions. I need to have two teeth removed, a lower first bicuspid and a second upper molar. According to the panoramic x-ray, there's no other issues. What is your opinion of dental implants? I'm a little leery about adding metal to my mouth. Let's take a moment, Judy, and cover each of your questions as if they were a single question, because they're so different. And I want to make sure that everybody can keep these topics in their heads. So let's start with dental implants. Once upon a time, people had teeth extracted and then they had dentures. And somewhere along the line, almost 25 to 30 years ago, it became much more common to put a threaded rod into your jaw and drill a hole in the bone, screw that thing in, give the bone a chance to heal around it, and then screw on a fake tooth. And these implants last, jury's still out. Let's just say if you get past 20 years, it's probably going to fail sooner or later. Long-term, not going to be as good. Rather like joints, when you do an artificial joint, we generally give them a 15 to 20-year lifespan. The metal eventually fatigues, unlike bone, which is constantly, unless you're messing with it with bisphosphonates, regenerating itself, breaking itself down and building itself back up, rather like your skin. That doesn't happen if you put a metal screw in there. Another thing that can happen, and I've seen it, and it does creep me out a little bit, is because your mouth is subject to, well, so much activity, and for a period of time, you've got this metal screw just sort of hanging out there and little fragments of metal coming off onto your gold teeth and things dropping down into your digestive tract where they may or may not actually trigger an inflammatory response, certain individuals can develop an allergy to metal. This is a known thing with the titanium hips and the titanium knees, and it's quite rare in that setting. I'm not so sure how rare it is in the mouth because I don't think the symptoms are going to be the same as they are with the joints, primarily skin and vascular. I'm a little worried that the teeth might give us a more internal symptom. But I'm not dissing implants entirely. I'm looking, if I ever need one, at bioceramic implants. These are zirconium. It's essentially a mineral, and this mineral can be synthesized into a screw and screwed into your jaw, and it bonds very well with bone. This technology is newer, but the stability has so far been very good, and I think I'd rather have a broken off piece of zirconium mineral, which is a non-toxic, than a piece of metal in my jaw should the implant fail. After the apocalypse or the, whatever version of eco, climate, COVID disaster that you wake up thinking about at 3 a.m. So I'm suggesting take a look at bioceramic implants. You can find doctors in most large cities who are doing those. And Columbus, Ohio, I'm sure, is no exception. Your second question. I have had scintillating scotomas infrequently over the years, not followed by migraine pain, though I have had unrelated painful headaches and migraines. Now, all of a sudden, I'm having weekly scintillating scotomas lasting 20 to 30 minutes with no pain. Is this anything I should be worried about? Well, given that later on, Judy, you tell us that you are 69, yes, I do think that you should worry about this. We're all under a lot of stress, a lot of extra stress. It's a stressful society. Now we have the economy, the election, and this lovely pandemic to add to our stress. It's been quite a stressful year, and I'm seeing lots of manifestations like that. And I suspect that your scintillating scotomas are a combination of possible sleep deprivation, a possible change in your consumption habits, maybe more chocolate or other foods containing tyramine. More about that in a moment. And I'm worried that this could be something that might give you an increased stroke risk. This is a migraine variant. Migraines are spasms of the blood vessel walls, which means that the part of the brain that's giving you those scotomas isn't getting enough blood. So the refresh rate on the screen is slow. The image, you're getting an after image, and flashing lights are not a good thing to be having. What you need to do about that, we'll get to in a moment. I'm glad you're not having pain, but if you were younger, you'd probably would be having migraines. This does create an increased stroke risk. So the first thing I'm going to suggest is that you look up, and you can use a website. My favorite website is myfooddata.com for this, and use their excellent search engine and look for foods high in tyramine, T-Y-R-A-M-I-N-E. So you're looking for taking tyramine foods, and this would be things like aged meats, sausage, pepperoni, salami, cheeses, particularly hard cheeses. Lots of red wine contains tyramine, so you'd want to probably take alcohol out. I would also suggest doing active daily stress reduction practices, possibly just slow, deep breathing to some relaxing music. 5 breaths in, hold for 5, 5 breaths out, hold for 5. This is a very simple way to raise your parasympathetic tone, and this will tend to dilate blood vessels rather than tighten them up. So if you're doing that a couple of times a day, maybe an aggregate of 20 to 30 minutes a day, split over 2 or 3 segments, that should be very helpful. And the last thing I would do is, unless you have a kidney issue, and if you're healthy, kidneys are what you possess, then increasing your magnesium. This is a muscle relaxant for the blood vessel wall and can be very helpful in these circumstances. So increased magnesium. I usually have people start with about 300 milligrams of magnesium glycinate 2 or 3 times a day. Unlike milk of magnesia, which is magnesium oxide, milk of magnesia obviously intended to make you poop. The magnesium glycinate does 2 things. One of them is it absorbs more readily, so you don't have a diarrhea situation. And it actually promotes sleep, because glycine is a sleep promoter, and increasing sleep tends to reduce the frequency of these pre-migraine type things. Coming now to Judy's last question. 12 years ago, a doctor performed an EKG and stated I have Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. I've never had any issues or any follow-up EKGs. Should I be concerned? Well, yes, Judy, I'm afraid you've given me a number of reasons to put ghosts into your head, but hey, it's seasonal. So here we go. Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome is a condition that predisposes you to several important kinds of rapid heartbeat. These are called tachyarrhythmias. They're very tacky. Tachy is, I believe, Greek for fast, by the way. And these fast rhythms can sometimes fool a doctor into thinking that they're looking at a heart attack. And there's a particular little signature. You know what an EKG looks like. And there's a kind of prolongation of the upstroke on the QRS wave. This is called a delta wave. You'll sometimes see something similar in athletic heart when to the novice cardiologist or student studying cardiology, I should say, because there are, of course, no novice cardiologists. By the time you get through that training, you're the opposite of a novice. But when I was learning to read EKGs, I made that mistake several times and was corrected. When you get one of these tachyarrhythmias, what's happening is that there's a short circuit in your heart, and the signal from your sinus node is stuttering. So you know how you get feedback if you've got, say, your phone on, talking to someone, and then you'll start the Zoom meeting? Well, that I've been doing that a lot lately. That is a example of feedback. And if you want to consider that what's going on in your heart is a feedback, you hear how the word gets doubled and the sound kind of reverberates. Well, imagine if that was a heartbeat that was reverberating. You'd be sending 2 or maybe 3 times more rapid signals to the ventricle to beat. And if you ask your ventricle to beat at 250 beats per minute, it can't do it. It doesn't have time for the blood to fill it so that it can pump the blood, and that's the equivalent to completely collapsing your blood pressure, and, well, obviously not a good thing. So there are some drugs that definitely increase your risk of having, especially atrial fib, atrial flutter, there are lots of nuances here. But what we're saying is it could set you up for a rapid heartbeat. That would be bad. And I'm going to give you a list of drugs that you should never take. You need to make sure that the Wolff-Parkinson-White is on a medical alert bracelet. That should be there. You should wear it. It should be in your wallet that you have this. And now that we're in the electronic age, my recommendation is get an EKG. You can go in and get a physical and You can go into your primary care doctor's office. Most of them have an EKG machine, and if they don't, they can certainly refer you for one. Get yourself an image file. It's called a PDF, or there's other versions, but I would go with the PDF because almost everyone and their electronic medical record can read them. And you're going to carry that around on a little fob on your key ring so that people can look at your EKG. If you develop chest pain or you're in a car accident or anything like that, they'll be able to compare your heart rate under that circumstance to the old EKG and possibly avoid making a significant clinical error. Also, they will not give you any of the following drugs. The first one's adenosine, which is very important because adenosine is often given in narrow complex tachyarrhythmias, which is to say they can give you exactly the wrong drug trying to treat your problem if they don't know that you have WPW. The next drugs to avoid are calcium channel blockers, and that would include verapamil, which tends to be the drug that we give for atrial fibrillation to slow it down when it's fast. And again, there's a possibility of mistaken identity here and actually meaning well, but giving you a drug that will make you worse. Beta blockers are also problematic. The whole class of calcium channel blockers. Interestingly enough, beta blockers are sometimes used to stop an attack of tachyarrhythmia, but they are also known to increase the risk of them, so we don't give these to people as a preventative. And this, too, is used to prevent certain other types of supraventricular tachycardias. So if you haven't gotten my point, I'll just spell it out. You need a label on your body and a label in your wallet saying, I have this. There's a copy of my EKG on my key ring. And please don't kill me, Mr. Doctor or Mrs. Doctor. So let's take a moment. I need to take a deep breath, and you probably do as well after that.
We have Barb on the line with the first phone call.
Howard, let's go straight to Barb.
Hi there.
Hi, Barb. How are you?
Good. I am going to be flying in December to Puerto Rico, and they require a COVID test 72 hours before flying. And I'm going to visit my mom, who's very elderly, and I would like to get tested before I see her, thinking that I could possibly catch something on the plane. I don't know what the likelihood of that is, but how long should I wait before I take a second COVID test once I arrive for it to be valid? Do you have to wait for when symptoms might show up?
Well, okay, so let's, I'm not quite sure, obviously you want to get on the airplane, so you have to be
right
within that.
In order to arrive there, they want, I think it's more for contact tracing than anything, but they want to know that you've had a test within 72 hours of getting on the plane. But once
you had a test or have a negative result? I mean, are they
going
to let you on the plane without
a certain... No, because when you get there, from what I understand, it's like they'll ask you, did you get tested? It's like, yes. Okay, did you get your results? It could be either yes or no, and they give you a code for either or. And then if you haven't had either, I forget what they do. They make you, quarantine yourself or something, I think. But nobody's monitoring it. But I'm going to do the test.
Yeah,
but,
okay.
The results don't come in time to fly, but you can get the results and then show them. And then they just, it's kind of a contact tracing tool more than anything.
All right. Certainly the airlines.
But then once I get there, I don't want to threaten my family from maybe picking something up from traveling.
Right.
And I don't know what the stats are on flying.
The stats on flying are actually pretty good. It depends on the airline, but the measures that many of the airlines are taking, which is they don't fill the middle seat and they stagger people, and everyone wears a mask and they don't serve food. I definitely would not eat on the airplane. But because the airplanes have very high-powered HEPA filters, and they're clearing the cabin air very frequently. I read one article that said something like six times a minute the air gets completely, refiltered. And that's way better than indoor spaces in general. Even a restaurant with some windows open probably isn't getting anywhere near that level of filtration. And we haven't seen major outbreaks on flight attendants, for example, the people who are staffing these planes, and you'd expect them to be the sort of proverbial canary in the coal mine. We're starting to feel more comfortable. I also have a paper that was done. They were trying to mimic the conditions of someone who was actively shedding virus. And so they had a mannequin that they wired to inhale and exhale. And when it exhaled, it exhaled particles, not COVID virus particles, but particles that would be presumed to come out in droplets and filter around the room in the same way. And they had a bunch of other sensors in all of the other seats. And the results were actually very good. So I think if we could have short flights, I don't know how long it takes. Is it a direct flight or do you change planes
in Florida
or something?
8 hours in the air, two different flights.
Right. So, trying not to eat while you're on the flight and bringing...
And a friend of mine who is a nurse said don't go to the bathroom either.
Not unless you've got an N95 mask, and if I think that honestly, I'm worried more about the bathrooms in the airport than I am the bathrooms on the plane. If you think about how that flush happens in a regular toilet without a seat, I think what we need to be telling people is close the lid before you flush on the airplane. And we don't have that luxury in most restaurants or airports. They don't have seats. They don't have lids, rather. And if you could close the lid, then the blast of particles and droplets that happen when you flush wouldn't be floating around in the bathrooms. I actually consider public bathrooms to be a rather riskier place, depending upon the prevalence, of course, in the area. But an airport... Certainly back before we understood what we were dealing with, I think a lot of spread and transmission probably did occur as people passed through airports. And the bathrooms, be hard to trace that because a month ago, did you use the toilet in the airport? You'd be flip a coin in terms of the accuracy of that. But your second question, how long do I wait after the incubation period for this thing is considered to be 2 weeks after a known exposure for a reason, because it can take 2 weeks after a known exposure for the person to incubate and start shedding virus, or it can be as few as 3 days. And that really stinks, but that's the situation. We've got this broad period of potential infectivity. I think that from a prudence standpoint, if you have a negative test when you get on the airplane and you were careful in the airport and you don't eat on the plane and you try to be in a well-ventilated space, you're in good shape from relatively low risk of picking it up. Not zero. You could get tested at the 3-day mark and again at the 7-day mark, assuming that you can get testing. You probably would not be infectious before 3 days. You could basically wait till you get that negative test and be very safe going and seeing your mother at that point. Not completely safe, so you're going to wear a mask. And if you eat, you're going to eat outside. And you're going to be 6 feet apart. And you're going to actually do all this stuff because this is your mom. And you don't want to be the person who infected her mom with COVID. And you felt fine. So we do have to be very, very, very cautious when we visit the elders or when we're around the elders. If you can afford to score an N95 mask, I'd recommend doing that and just wearing that in the bathrooms. If you do have to go to the bathroom, pull that out and put it on because that will actually stop you from inhaling the virus. And if those N95s weren't doing the job, we'd have a lot more sick healthcare workers now. But we don't. And so if you follow the precautions work. You can buy those veterinary supply places will sometimes sell them. Many of the doctors have some, and if your doctor has enough, they might share one with you. You could always ask. And you want to take a look at the sourcing, as I say, if you buy it online. But Horst Schneider's has probably done that. I'd ask them, you know, how did you vet mm-hmm. these, that they came from
like
a reputable source?
$9 a piece.
Right, exactly. The best price I could find a couple months ago was $8 a piece. And they're still quite expensive. I think that we just have to consider that it's like, well, $10 for a mask. By the way, I'll tell you how to probably clean a mask and reuse it, because the healthcare workers in New York were wearing those masks for about a week. And what they would do is they would take them home and they would heat treat them. And you don't want to put them above boiling water. But if you put them on a vegetable steamer in a closed pot with a thermometer in the water, and you get the temperature above 150 but below 170, and just cook them in that setting, there have been several, and this is replicated, but there have been several studies that showed that that looks like a best practice. If you have several masks, you can also leave it out in bright sunlight and then flip it over, and an hour of bright sunlight will completely kill COVID. The problem is it's getting late in the year, and you can't let dew get the mask wet, so it's non-trivial to use outside light. There are definitely ultraviolet sterilizers. Those are very toxic, and it needs to be a special kind of UVC. So for the layperson, the steaming method, but you're not using steam, you're just using, you know, hot water vapor and not too much of it, can work very well.
All right. Well, thank you.
So good luck. Enjoy your visit with your mom, and thank you very much for the call.
All right. Bye-bye.
Let's take one more email. This comes from Virgin Z in Kirchner, Canada. Hello, Dr. Don. I'm a big fan of your program. You do such thorough, excellent analysis of the latest science and therapies. I enjoy your podcasts across the miles in Canada. Thank you for all you do. I'm writing about my 78-year-old mom who has osteoporosis. She was first diagnosed in her 50s after a fragility fracture of her wrist falling down the stairs. She went on to go on bisphosphonates, Fosamax, then Actonel for many years. She finally stopped them after some dental issues and dry mouth and dry throat issues. Her dentist was very concerned about osteonecrosis warnings for these meds. She's very active, walking, weight-bearing exercise, and has a robust diet which incorporates leafy greens and dairy. She's not been taking an osteoporosis medication for several years now. After a recent bone mineral density scan, she went to an endocrinologist, and the recommendation is for her to do reclassed IV infusions annually due to her bone loss. Would not this medication be contraindicated in someone who had issues with the bisphosphonate class of drugs previously? Would love to know your thoughts on this matter. As well, I am potentially pursuing a telehealth appointment for my mom who lives in New Jersey. How do prescriptions work with telehealth across state lines? With few exceptions, the telehealth works across state lines, and the prescriptions, at least for the duration of the emergency, are being honored. We have a lot of medical care and specialists who are stretched very thin, and everyone's agreed that as long as the person's board certified and in good standing in one state, they'd probably jump through the hoops in another. Telehealth has been something we've all been hoping to see grow, and the pandemic, has done some very major work. I'd say it's bumped us up 5 or 10 years forward from the previous timeline, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's way safer for a lot of the types of things that doctors used to see patients in the office for. Many things, nothing will replace that hands-on visit, but for rechecks on, you know, how are you doing, you know, what's your blood pressure log look like, and, oh, you know, here's your refill, any problems, no, okay, great, yeah, doctor, I've got this, you know, little thing on my arm, well, send me a picture, and if you can't get a good picture, you're going to have to see a dermatologist. But we can do a lot of work over the phone and over video, and I've obviously been giving medical advice for almost 30 years. and you develop some tricks. So I'm happy about the new telehealth horizon that is suddenly a lot closer than it used to be. Getting back to your mom's concern about the injections of Reclast. Reclast, as you correctly note, is a bisphosphonate, and these drugs work by making the bone undigestible by the osteoclasts. And as I was commenting to an earlier question from Judy in Columbus, bone fatigues, but metal fatigues a lot faster. Well, if you take a bisphosphonate, the normal healing process of the bone is impaired, and that is a problem that should be looked at. An alternative to think about might be Prolia, which is a trade name. The generic name is denosumab, D-E-N-O-S-U-M-A-B. This is given also by injection. It is available in Canada, I checked, and it blocks or impedes osteoclasts. So it prevents the generation from the stem cell of some of the osteoclasts. So essentially it affects your population, but it doesn't destroy the entire osteoclast population. So you do still get bone remodeling and bone healing, just at a much slower rate. That allows the bone building cells, which tend to get slower as we age. So the bone breakdown cells are still running fast. The bone rebuilding cells aren't, and that's where the steady bone loss comes from. So using the Rankl inhibitor that slows the formation of the osteoclasts is an option for your mom. It does not have the same side effects, in particular the osteonecrosis has been looked for and not reported, and the dry mouth issues would not be a problem. The dental issues, you can heal an implant or you can heal infected bones, so that's a plus. And it doesn't have the GI effects of the bisphosphonates, which can cause ulcers and esophagitis. They're very irritating to the lining of the esophagus. So she will have to take extra calcium. Calcium is depleted by this drug because one of the ways the body balances your calcium is, if it needs more calcium, it steals it from the bones, and it does that by stimulating the osteoclasts. Well, you can't do that in this circumstance. They're not able to ramp up because you've destroyed the signal that tells them to ramp up. So with the provisos, I think it would be worth talking to the endocrinologist about this drug and seeing if you might be able to get approval for that. And I see as I answer that actually I assume that your mom was in Canada with you, but actually she's in New Jersey, so that is definitely an available drug and something that, with the appropriate coding, should be able to get through her Medicare Part D. So she won't be looking at the outrageous cost of the agent. At least I don't think so. Now here we are in 2020, and you'd think that most anatomy, like gross anatomy, the Grant's anatomy kind of cut open the dead body and look for the nerve or look for the structure, you'd think most of the gross anatomy had already been discovered. But doctors may have found two new organs in the exact geometric center of your head, exactly in the middle, just behind where the nasal cavity meets the throat. There's a pair of undiscovered glands that were recently identified. They are very large, and they are salivary glands. And collectively, did you know that you make a quart of spit every day? Besides lubricating the mouth and making it easier to swallow, it does all sorts of things for your immune system. It helps with your digestion. It also has some curative powers and, of course, speeds up the closure of wounds in the mouth and in the gut. One of the side effects of radiation therapy for head and neck cancers is dry mouth. And in a recent set of highly, highly detailed scans from a new technology machines, researchers noticed there were these two funny-looking lumps in a flat, spindly glands, each a couple of inches in length, and they're just draped like a boneless cat over the eustachian tubes. And they didn't know they were there, so they hadn't really looked for them. So they went, dissected a few cadavers, and lo and behold, they found the glands. You need very sensitive imaging to detect it. That's why it's taken so long to discover. And it may account for why it's been so difficult to not cause dry mouth, because the people were trying to miss the known salivary glands with the radiation beams. For the radiation therapy, that the salivary glands that we knew about. This special kind of imaging technique was recently developed. It's basically a retread of MRI, and it was designed to look for tumorous growths in certain patient populations. This was actually developed for prostate and urethral gland cancer. It's amazing that it turns out to have another purpose. And this structure was basically just well hidden, and the technology couldn't resolve it, rather like not having a powerful enough microscope. So this is the third time that this has happened. When I was training in medicine, was the early days of CT scans. They'd been around for a while, but they were just starting to be common in every hospital and be something you needed to learn how to read. And it takes a while to learn to read a new technology. When MRIs were developed, and this would have been in the late 80s and the early 90s, there were a number of things that nobody expected to see. We hadn't seen them on CT scans, and we weren't really sure what they meant when we saw them on MRIs. Initially, they were called fascinomas because they were fascinating. We also didn't know about them. And one of the things I remember particularly was white specks in the brain. Now, if you're looking at a CT of the brain and you see white specks, you become very worried that you're looking at multiple sclerosis. In the case of the MRI, most people, or many of them anyway, have these white specks, and this is a dilemma. Do you tell the person, well, you've got these white spots, you don't have any symptoms of multiple sclerosis, but, you know, keep me on speed dial, and if you develop pain, weakness, or anything weird, give me a call. Talk about putting a ghost in someone's head. That definitely, definitely does that. Now, you all know I'm very fond of genetics and epigenetics, so my next two stories are about genetics, and I think I can get through them in 5 minutes, so here we go. Radiation from cell phones has been associated with higher rates of thyroid cancer in some epidemiologic reports, but not all. There have also been reports linking high levels of cell phone use to acoustic neuromas. These researchers at the Yale School of Public Health looked at the records of 900 people in Connecticut, and they looked at the genetics and found that certain nucleotide polymorphisms, called single nucleotide polymorphisms, just a single letter in the DNA was wrong. People who had these changes were significantly more likely to develop thyroid cancer. They looked at cell phone use and correlated with frequency and how much cell phone use. And of the known genes that are associated with thyroid cancer, four of them seem to be made substantially worse, twice as likely to develop thyroid cancer. They looked at a total of 176 known genes that have been linked with thyroid cancer, and they found 10 that seem to be specific for creating problems in cell phone users. Now, what would you do if you had that SNP and you wanted to be cautious? You might, for example, use a headset, a wired headset, and keep your cell phone a couple feet away rather than holding it up to your head and neck. Many people are switching to Bluetooth. I'm not sure about the radiation and the EMF coming off Bluetooth, and so I'll have to take the fifth on whether that's safer, but I do know for a fact that a wired headset is safer, and that's what I continue to use. The researchers were able to list the specific SNPs, and if you've had your 23andMe done, you could actually check your raw file and see whether or not you had them. We'll post a link to the article on the website, and so that you can go look and get the list. I'm RSID codes, and they're just gobbledygook. They look like long-distance phone numbers, and they don't provide us. My producer informs me is a low energy level, and so the probability of this causing a problem is probably also low. So thank you for allowing me to get that correction out. The last story, also looking at genetic variations, they were looking for genetic variations that showed why certain young people got such severe COVID. And they found that 3.5% of young people who got severe COVID had mutations in genes involving interferon. However, in doing the research, they found that 10% of young people with severe disease created autoantibodies that attack the immune system and prevent interferon from fighting off the disease. They found harmful antibodies in 100 out of 987, more than 10% of the severe cases. So the implications are if a person gets COVID, they should be tested for the autoantibodies. And those people need to be followed closely. We may be adding therapy in those individuals, such as filtering the antibodies out of their bloodstream, but that has not yet been proven. The genes are listed in the article, and the most important thing of this is that the autoantibody formation of antibodies against interferon is new. I've not seen this anywhere else, and it could turn out to be extremely important. Stay tuned, and tune in next week. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, stay safe, and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.